First case for argument, Boyd v. Meritor.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The complaint in this case raised contingent interdependent ERISA claims regarding Meritor's defined benefit plan. The plaintiffs challenged, among other things, Meritor's methods through the years of calculating lump sum distributions, a level of annuities paid annuitants, and the effect of amendments to its 2003 plan that plaintiffs say were unlawful or invalid. For all these claims, the plaintiffs sought all available relief. The district court certified the class under Rule 23b-2. Plaintiff proposed 11 subclasses, and the district court certified 10 of them. Meritor contends in this appeal that certification under B-2, in this case, was improper under Walmart v. Stukes.
And the court abstract from the any conflicts within the class, what then would be the practical objection to the B2 treatment? Suppose all the classes, through subclasses or what have you, we have a homogeneous class seeking a declaration that their pension benefits were improperly calculated. So there'd be a declaration. Suppose they prevailed, have a declaration. And then the individual class members would ask for, their correct amount of benefits, and there would be some individual hearings and some questions like statute of limitations, particularly individuals, would be raised. Is there anything wrong with that approach to a case like this?
Your Honor, that sounds something like Your Honor's opinion in the Berger case. And in the Berger case, there was a single issue involved. It was whether the...
I'm telling you to abstract from any conflicts within the class and tell me what practical objection, if any, there is to treating this as a B-2 class action.
There's a large objection. We don't think it can be treated as a B-2. First of all, as the court said in Walmart versus Dukes, it can't be resolved on a single
issue. I'm asking for a practical objection.
The practical objection is one of the claims that's core to the plaintiff's lawsuit is this claim that through the years, a series of amendments to a pension plan, in effect, amended the pension plan as a matter of law. We don't think that's so. The practical objection is...
No, but what's the problem with having that decided in a class action?
Either they did or they didn't. I mean, actually, the plaintiffs say this is one of three theories they have, but let's assume for the moment it's the only one. Why wouldn't you like to have this resolved once and for all for everybody?
We think, as a practical matter, that would require evidence in every single year over a period of 23 years as to the circumstances.
So you want to have that determined in 4,000 different cases or what?
We don't think the claim has merit, but yes, we think the claim, because it seeks money damages, has to be determined.
For the practical advantages, if any, of treating this either as a B3 case or as individual suits.
Another practical advantage would be,
you haven't named one practical advantage yet.
One practical advantage is these subclasses are, there's 10 of them, or 9 of them.
Let's forget the subclasses for a moment. Let's just assume we're dealing with one subclass with a uniform challenge.
It's not a uniform challenge. Each subclass raises a variety of claims. It raises a variety of claims, Your Honor.
So you have 10 class actions. I mean, I would point out to you that Rule 23C4, even post-Walmart, permits issues classes. Rule 23C5, especially post-Walmart, encourages subclasses. And the district court, to my examination of the record, has not even yet come to a final decision about whether separate counsel will be needed for the different subclasses. So I think your conflict argument at best is premature, and at worst fails to grapple with the fact that if there's a simple declaration that can be made here and then a formula into which people's funds can be plugged, subject to your ability to raise your limitations argument. Of course, you have that right. I don't see what the problem is.
You
put a lot of weight on the single word individualized in Walmart, and I think maybe more than it can bear.
Your Honor, our point is this reasonable expectations claim. It's their claim. It's not our claim. It requires a separate evidence through many, many years.
So what if we completely disregard, we carve out that theory? You have seized on one part of this case, and it makes me think that you really don't want to be in the other territory.
But we don't want to have to deal with the reasonable expectations.
No, you don't. You don't want to look at their other arguments relating to the way this particular plan was written, the way it was administered. You want it all to be a completely subjective test, which seems to me, over the long run, for companies in your position, to be a nightmare. If you're supposed to delve into the brain of all the people who are participants in the plan.
We asserted that the subjectivity part, based upon the court's decision in the S.C. Johnson case and the statute of limitations, which had an either-or test for determining whether the statute of limitations would apply.
Yeah, but you also want a subjectivity test for what the terms of the plan are and for when it was amended. And, you know, if somebody says, you know, I sincerely believed that it was amended, you seem to want that. I mean, what if you were Boeing or something? You had hundreds of thousands of people. It doesn't seem at all rational.
Well, Your Honor, we took the depositions of the individual plaintiffs down below. The plaintiffs have this theory on the reasonable expectations. The reason we're focused on it is because we don't think this theory has any water. But more importantly, for class purposes, nobody testified in support of this theory, in support of it.
So what weight does the word reasonable have in your mind? That's usually a signal of an objective standard.
Yeah, a judge makes the judgment based upon the materials in each given year and makes a judgment. But it's not irrelevant that the...
So you would agree that you're avoiding confrontation of their other theories? That
no.
Your case rises or falls on whether this third theory about the way the plan was being administered...
Not avoiding it. We're saying that that theory permeates their complaint, and that's what makes it fatal under B2.
But let me tell you a problem with the way this whole thing unfolds. It's a problem for you. It's a problem for us. The general trend of class actions has been to push more and more issues to the front end of the case, whether it's discovery, whether it's experts, whether it's assessing what theories are in a case. There hasn't been a motion to dismiss in this case. There hasn't been a summary motion. People don't need to plead legal theories and complaints. They are at a stage where whatever the complaint plausibly will support is something that they are entitled to raise. That's the result of Walmart. It's the result of Twombly and Iqbal. It's the result of a lot of things. So it really leaves you at a point where you may think things aren't in the case, but they may be.
We're not avoiding those. What we've done is we've focused on the things that are core to their complaint that we think takes it out of B2. That's what we've done.
Would you be happier with a B3?
We'd be happy with no class, Your Honor. But B3 is where the B3 is where the B3 is where we thought the analysis should be.
I don't see why there can't be a B2 on an issue, and then if later on there need to be individual proceedings, the question is, as Walmart puts it, is there a broad-based issue that's the same for everybody in the class? Either, you know, there was an amendment effective January 1, 2003, or there wasn't, or they were bad before and now they aren't, or whatever. Then that's suitable for B2. Of course, there was nothing of the sort in Walmart itself in the case, and these ERISA cases are quite different from the mess that had been presented to the court in Walmart.
They are. The issue preclusion, or excuse me, issue certification could work in a case like this. That's not how the plaintiffs moved. Each of those classes that they've identified, the subclasses, has various issues that raise the individualized issues that we focused on.
So there are about 4,000 people involved, is that correct?
Something like that, yes.
What do you think their average claim is?
I don't have that number, Your Honor.
Oh, you must know. The company must know what its potential liability is.
Depending if you credit the reasonable expectations argument.
Give me a number.
I can't do the math based upon...
There are a couple of questions. One is whether it is feasible, given the amount that these people are claiming, for them to bring these as individual suits. That's one question, which you can't answer. So we'll forget that. Second question is whether this is somehow would be better or different as a B3. So what would be the advantage? Are you worried that, I mean, not that you would actually be worried, but is there a concern here that a B2 would harm class members, that they would somehow be bound by a declaration or an injunction when they had no notice? Is that the problem?
That underlies it. I mean, it's the beer case.
See, that's where
that
I think you're,
well,
you're mistaking something about this case, because in the classic B3 case, people have a right to opt out because their situation may be different. They may wish to pursue different theories. And it's possible for the defendant to tailor its response to each class member accordingly. This is actually almost a little closer to B1. I can't believe your company wants a situation in which, as to persons 1 through 2,000, the 2003 amendment was valid, but as to persons 2001 through 4,000, the 2003 plan amendment was not valid. That's an intolerable situation. You really need either validity or non-validity. And so I think the opt-out right, I mean, you're sort of reciting what people say in B3 cases, but it's a poor fit for this case. And I would also point out to you, in response to what Judge Posner was talking about, on page 13 of your brief, you are discussing English, who's one of the subclass representatives. Her account balance as of 12/31/95 was $31,113.58. Presumably, if it had been, well, and then it was going to go up to 57,000 and some. So if interest had accrued differently, it would have been more, but it doesn't sound like huge dollars to me.
It depends on all the other theories that the plaintiffs are raising.
No, if you had indexed according to this system they were talking about, that should be possible to just sit down with the calculator and figure out.
I mean, the index that they're talking about, plaintiffs' counsel can do better than I can. But
the greater of either 4% or 75% of the plan's returns for the previous year. Now, the plan's returns for the previous year don't vary by class member. The plan got whatever returns it got.
That's their claim. Our plan does not provide for that. It's not in the plan. The plan provides for a 4% increase, and their theory, this reasonable expectation...
Well, what about the 75%?
It doesn't provide for that either.
Well, that's your merits argument, but I'm just saying if the plan got returns, it only got one number, you know, for a year. This is not a number that's going to be different by class member. You may prevail on the merits and show that there was no such 75% number. I have no idea. But I don't see why it's not common to the class.
We didn't argue commonality. We recognize there are common issues in the class. And
right, so this is the same issue for every member of the class. And if you could knock it out in a class action, you'd get rid of it for all 4,435 people.
Our problem is it spans 23 years with all the varying circumstances.
But that's going to be true, yeah, even of individuals. Some of the individuals have 23 years in. I just don't understand that you didn't make individual representations to each employee. You made group representation.
That's correct. But those representations varied in each year along the way, and the court would have to evaluate each set of representations along the way. And what we're saying, because of that, it shouldn't be treated as...
God, did your screw-ups should spoil a class action. What's this... I don't mean you personally, of course. The company, with its totally incoherent... pension plan. Now, you say this 75%, it doesn't exist? It's not in the case, or what?
It's not in the plan document, Your Honor. The other cases that have been before...
Where did it come from?
That is a claim made by the plaintiffs that...
Did the company ever say 75%?
I don't think so. I mean, from here...
Where did they get the idea that it would be 4% or 75% of, you know, last year's earnings or what have you?
The plan provides for 4%. Maybe
you can tell me this is wrong, but on page 11 of your opponent's brief, contract theory number one, they cite to the pension committee's resolution establishing, and then they put quotation marks, the indexing rate for any calendar year otherwise applicable under paragraph 3.14A shall be amended to be the greater of 75% of the actual rate of return on trust assets for that year, or 4%. So I mean, if it's the pension committee rather than company, it seems to me you're splitting hairs.
This pension committee, Your Honor, makes an amendment each year to the plan. That's how this company
did it. And I'm
just
saying, if you told Judge Posner that the 75% number doesn't come from anywhere, but...
It doesn't come from the plan, Your Honor. This is an amendment. This particular document is disputed by the parties, and its effect is disputed by the parties. It's not in the plan.
Not the same as they're pulling it out of thin air, though. I mean, there's a pension committee resolution talking about the indexing rate. I mean, so there's one, if you want to, on the merits, debate the legal effect of that.
In the other years, Your Honor, there's nothing like this.
You keep mixing the merits with the class certification issue by saying the 75% doesn't exist.
It's not in the plan document. Your Honor is correct.
That's a merits issue, whether there was any commitment to provide this boost. I thought that was... let me ask you then. This pension committee, why did it add the 75%? Well, what's that about?
This is a particular document.
Why did it do it? What's the motive?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
In prior years, the committee had targeted a return that was close to 75% in some years. The plaintiff is arguing because they did that, it became a permanent feature of the plan.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jackson. Got us, Dina?
Respectfully, Your Honor did not get an answer to Your Honor's question about what is the practical objection to class certification. And actually, Judge Wood pointed to the practical objections, as did Your Honor, and Your Honor as well, from the company's point of view, because they're going to have incompatible standards of conduct unless there is a single ruling. They can't do any of the seven things that we identify in our motion. And Judge Connolly, if you look at the defendant's brief, Essay 32, is the special appendix, the very last page of Judge Connolly's opinion, he created a chart for him to keep track of all the moving parts. And those seven requests are, in effect, the seven parts of the injunction that we seek. And the practical...
That's the vertical column, right?
That's correct. As to each of those seven, we're either right or wrong. It's either yay or nay, and the company doesn't want to have a case in the Western District of Wisconsin and the Eastern District telling it to do different things for people who are not just similarly situated but identically situated.
But what about the general concern with the B2 is lack of notice, right?
That's, yes.
So aren't there some members of this class or the classes who might be harmed by the injunction?
No, Your Honor, no one can be harmed by the injunction, and the district court was quite correctly dismissive of the argument that the defense made that there was some sort of conflict as to the plan amendment issue.
So could I ask you, has the district court, as of right now, issued a final order defining these subclasses and appointing class counsel?
No, he has not.
There is no final order. So if... at the remedy stage, if one formula is better for one subclass and a different formula is better for a different one, presumably he'll appoint separate counsel.
That's what he specifically said that he could do. And that's why the case is so premature that, it, in our view, it's not even a close question. You'd first have to establish liability. You'd also have to establish that there was really a conflict in any substance, and they're effectively manufacturing a conflict that doesn't exist. It's very, very unlikely.
Do you have any notion of why the pension committee would have wanted to add this this boost with this 75% rule, why they'd want to increase the entitlement?
Yes. What they were doing at the time was, at least according to the limited information we have so far, we haven't taken any depositions and we haven't completed document discovery, is that they were memorializing what they had already, in effect, decided at the outset of the case, at the outset of the plan, rather, which is, Your Honor asked, did they ever tell anybody about the 75%? No, they didn't. They said it behind the scenes. In effect, what they did was they had it both ways. They had the benefits of suggesting to people in communications that on an annual basis, the indexing rate would be, which they didn't call an indexing rate, would be greater than 4%. And they left it very vague as to how that would occur. But behind the scenes, at all times, it was 75% of plan asset returns. Apparently something happened, according to the document that Your Honor pointed to, where they said that they wanted to make it more explicit than it was in the actual plan document.
So this was some sort of public relations or employee relations. They're telling them they're making the plan more generous, but they're avoiding detail.
But they're avoiding, and this is what the IRS is concerned with, which was only one of our three theories, but on this pattern regulation, what the IRS is concerned with is, in effect, the employer having it both ways, suggesting that there's a benefit, but then when push comes to shove, it's not literally written there. So they would have a pattern where one after another, they would say, well, it's just for this year, and the IRS says, no, you're really creating a plan term. And that plan term, again, this case is simply uniform as to everyone in all regards. It applies to everybody. If you look at Judge Connolly's chart, those seven requests, issues, that would be the seven-part injunction. And actually, Your Honors both mentioned at the beginning something about individual hearings. This case doesn't have any other individual hearings. What it has is an actuary sitting in front of a computer with a mouse click down an Excel sheet. Whatever
So Judge Connolly said, let me just interrupt you because this may be important for the Walmart issue, looking at post-Walmart cases was saying if it's mechanical, by which I understood to mean if there's actually just a formula that you put numbers into and the computer spits a final number out, that is distinguishable from, at the other extreme, the kind of hearings that would have been necessary in Walmart, where every single woman would have had to testify about every single supervisor and what the local store was doing and on and on and on. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. In that case, in these employment cases, there's effectively a separate element that each person must prove. Let's say in Walmart, all the justices agreed where they were in conflict, and they said this is common. Let's say it was 9-0 on that instead of 5-4. And there was a trial, and they tried the issue, and it was Walmart is a gender discriminator. They would still have to, that was the point that everybody agreed on in the Supreme Court, was they would still have to have these totally separate mini-trials for each person. Why was I disfavored? Was it because of the discrimination? The beauty in this case is that it's just a formula. There is no further elements for us to prove. We don't have to prove that we really, each person doesn't have to come in and says, well, I really did work hard for those benefits.
So what about the statute of limitations defense, for example? Aren't there things that will vary for that?
There's not. First, let's look at what it is that they say. What they say is they have the right to show actual knowledge. In theory, that may not be wrong. But what do they point to? What do they proffer? They proffer the testimony of the plaintiffs who all said, 2-1, based on what they were told, they understood that if they took a lump sum, they would get this thing called their account balance. put aside, as Your Honor pointed out, they actually didn't even have accounts, not even notional accounts. But they were told that they would get their account balance. The defense theory is that that's a trigger of limitations. Well, the problem with that is that doesn't work in this case because this case is not like the S.E. Johnson case, but rather the S.E. Johnson case distinguished the Young v. Verizon case. There's a hidden plan term. There's a subsidized eight-factor lump sum that they never told anybody. So the key to accrual is everybody has everything that they need to see that they were injured. But in the Young v. Verizon case, there was a second.
So because of concealment, you're saying that they didn't.
Or just nondisclosure. It was in the plan document, and it was never disclosed. And they don't have the point as actual knowledge. They don't proffer anybody ever getting some telepathic message that there was a secret eight-factor subsidized lump sum factor in the plan document that entitled them to more than the account. All they're doing, in effect, to sum up, is their actual knowledge point is just a constructive knowledge point. And Judge Connolly understood that. And he said, well, I can just look at all the communications, which counsel admitted were uniform. He said they may have changed from year to year, but they're just a couple pieces of paper. We stipulate, we agree that everyone's actual knowledge was, to the extent they read the stuff, they would think they'd get the account. But
In a sense, you're just saying that's not the issue.
It's not.
It's a sidelight.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I would just pick up on something Your Honor said also, coming back to the B1 issue, is this would be a case for B1A as well as B2, because the plan simply can't have two rules for participants who are
wouldn't that imperil its tax qualification if it was non-uniform?
Well, I would, yes, and I would point the court to what we cite in our briefs about when they went to the IRS. The IRS threw up its hands when it read this document. The IRS said, you're telling people one thing, the plan document says another, and what the IRS proposed to fix the problem very much parallels the seven issues that Judge Connolly identified. They withdrew their request for tax qualification. This is class-wide relief. This is when you have these, everything is perspective. These are benefits. We don't even seek damages.
What about the lump sum people who have already received their lump sum in that early phase? I understand that for the annuitants, it's certainly prospective. I understand for people who haven't retired yet, it's prospective. What about the people who already got a lump sum?
It's also prospective because this is ERISA and these are pension benefits. Indulge me for a second so I can explain. Money is usually substitutionary. Here, we want the real thing. We want benefits. They made a distribution to Ms. English that was discussed in the opening. That distribution was a partial distribution of her accrued benefit. She has, or we want a declaration that so says, residing in the plan, the balance of her accrued benefit. Money is not even an adequate substitute. We want benefits for at least three reasons. Tax-qualified benefits. Benefits are different from money because the plan has different forms in which people can elect. So Ms. English, while she, and most people will, say, well, give me the remainder of the lump sum that I should have received, she also has the right to take it as an annuity. That's protected by law because this is ERISA. Also, she has the right to defer the receipt and to keep those monies immune from creditors. So this is not even a damages action, and Your Honor's decisions in prior cases sometimes make that explicitly clear. Sometimes the court says damages and benefits. Damages is just a shorthand in those circumstances for benefits. We want the rest, specific performance, the real thing. So it's not even, there's not a past injury. In ERISA, you can't actually even forfeit your benefit. It's sitting there in the plan. So we seek prospective injunctive relief for everyone, including the lump sum people like Ms. English. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Gottesdiener. Mr. Jackson, your time expired. We'll give you another minute if you'd like.
We checked, Your Honor, in answer to your question, Ms. Boyd left with about $65,000 as her lump sum. She's claiming $131,000.
Don't we need to substitute plaintiffs since she seems to be out for other reasons?
Yes, and that's what Judge Conley has back in the district court.
So he, at some point, it seems a little bizarre to have her name on the
Your Honor, to answer Your Honor's question, that's a significant increase if the plaintiffs are correct about this, and that's Appendix 49. And Judge Wood, in response to your questions about Walmart, we think that there were back pay proceedings that required Walmart, and the court said that those proceedings took out the back pay claims in that case from the B2 construct.
No, I remember that. I mean, but they were. My only point is that in the context of the nature of the claim, the Title VII claims in Walmart, it looks to me to be quite different. There was certainly nothing formulaic whatsoever about the Walmart situation.
And our point is we'd analogize the reasonable expectations and the statute of limitations to the back pay point in Walmart.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.